the only way that you can do that, the only way that you can get away with that much criminality and not spend a day in jail is if you're working with the government. That is the only way.
Welcome back to another episode of Deadly Diocese. Thank you guys so much for listening and for your interest and care in Father Joe's story. A care that I believe from heaven Father Joe is using all of us to work through to continue his legacy of care and vigilance in protecting harmed and abused children and adults within the Catholic Church and beyond. And I also want to say a special thank you to our patrons. Specifically, and I don't know if she'd want her name made public, so I'm not going to say it, but a specific patron who is time-coded and made data so unbelievably professional and helpful in combing through the surveillance footage of the day Father Joe died. So on our Patreon, we've been uploading, you know, two-hour segments from that day to see if anyone recognizes anyone, if they're, or if just a second set of, or 100 set of eyes notice something like a car coming and going, you know, that is, it's anything that you notice that is weird, two people in the basement. That is partially why we set up the Patreon, because so much of this investigation is also visual. So if you'd like to see that, go to patreon.com/deadlypodcast. We will also be doing a deep dive into the footage as this investigation continues, and we'll share that on future episodes here as well. Okay. Now for the episode. These next two episodes, we are going to be speaking with Nick Bryant, and I promise it will become clear why in relation to Father Joe's story. But first, who is Nick Bryant? Nick is an acclaimed journalist who has been on the front lines of exposing corruption and child sex abuse and trafficking on the largest of scales. Nick Bryant is the journalist that exposed Jeffrey Epstein's Little Black Book, releasing the names of the elite of the elite, Trump, Clinton, Bill Gates. In Nick's words in a Vanity Fair article written by Joe Pompeo, where he interviewed Nick, Nick states, "It's a mosaic of Epstein's social contacts." Nick also released publicly for the first time Epstein's flight logs. Nick first got his hands on a copy of the Black Book in 2012, after the feds caught Epstein's former house manager trying to peddle it for $50,000. At the time, Bryant was shopping a feature on Epstein, but without success. He said, quote, "My Epstein article would focus on the government malfeasance that enabled Epstein to skate on scores of child abuse charges. And I would also look into the covert ties that the government may have had with Epstein. This is a pitch that Nick Bryant had written to various editors in order to get this story out. But no one wants to touch this kind of thing. No one wants to go up against the government or powerful, rich people. In a similar way with Father Joe's case, the DA, law enforcement, didn't want to touch his story. No one wanted to go up against the Catholic Church. Similar to Father Joe, too, Nick is no holds barred, willing to stand up to the man, to anyone, in order to get the truth and protect the vulnerable. He has lived a seasoned, storied life and is one of the most interesting people that I've recently been able to call a friend. And I thought he could give insight for Father Joe's story because, number one, we found a link. Number two, Nick has tracked down, solved, exposed the biggest of the biggest dark, corrupt secrets of the Catholic Church, the government, the elite, and beyond. Number three, he has faced the kind of danger that Father Joe, unfortunately, succumbed to by being a brave whistleblower and fighter for justice and protection of children. Nick stated in that Vanity Fair article, "There are some stories that are just too wild to be reckoned with while they're happening. You kind of need a historical perspective." Now enter the Franklin scandal. The Franklin scandal is a story Nick spent over 10 years on the road, researching and writing about, interviewing victims, perpetrators, digging up any and all information to initially want to disprove something that was so hard to grasp. But what he came out with was, this happened. It happens, and it is the truth. The Franklin scandal, and I encourage you, if you are interested in this type of thing, which you must be because you're listening to the podcast about Father Joe, but the Franklin scandal is a chilling expose of corporate corruption and government cover-ups. It's an account of a nationwide child trafficking and pedophilia ring in the United States. It tells a sordid tale of corruption in high places. The scandal originally surfaced during an investigation into Omaha, Nebraska's failed Franklin Credit Union that went beyond the Midwest, ultimately to Washington, D.C., implicating businessmen, senators, major media corporations, the CIA, and even the venerable Boys Town Organization, that very, very famous Catholic organization. This extensively researched report by him includes firsthand interviews with key witnesses and explores a controversy that has received scant media attention because no one wants to talk about this. They do want to cover it up, even if that means silencing someone by death. The Franklin scandal is a story that Nick Bryant didn't want to believe, nor did I when I initially read his book and obsessively recorded about 9 episodes on my other podcast, 7 Deadly Sinners, on it. But once Nick started digging, once he made the connections, once he spoke to the victims who didn't want to speak, he was almost beat up by one of them because the wound was so deep with that man. Many victims were now drug addicted, destitute because of what happened to them at Boys Town, the famous Catholic organization in Nebraska, and beyond that. I have also spoken with one of the victims of the Franklin scandal. She reached out to me just randomly on Facebook, and it actually made me cry. It made me feel very, you know, validated in the work I had done, you know, researching the Franklin scandal and her story. And she also appeared on an episode of 7 Deadly Sinners. And when you speak to these people, when you speak to a victim, it's so hard not to believe them, especially when they really almost don't want to talk about it. Like, she wanted to talk more about the work she's doing now as an adult in the future to, you know, help victims like Father Joe was trying to help, like Nick is. And they also started a foundation together. I encourage you to look that up. Their foundation is called Epstein Justice, and it's Nick Bryant and Alicia Owen. Alicia, who was a victim of the Franklin scandal and is speaking out and fighting back. So again, I encourage you to look that up. But they do events around the country, fundraising, and yeah, because this is all extremely, extremely important stuff. And now, without further ado, here's our conversation with Nick Bryant.
Okay, Frank, are you still a Catholic or have you...
So I don't have to listen to Rome.
My God, did you hear that? Sorry. So I did delete. Nick, did you hear that? Not to freak you out, but we're unsure. Sorry, now we're going to get sidetracked. Did you hear that, like, airdrop noise on the phone?
I did.
So that's been happening every time we've been talking. Gina also found a tracking device on her vehicle. We can get into it later, but we're not sure if someone's listening or not. We don't quite know what's happening. It's happened now the last couple days. We've talked on the phone, and I'm not connected to internet. I don't have any AirTag near me. I don't have any AirDrop on. I don't.
And it's only when she speaks to me. Like, when we're connected, other people can be too, but when it's Rachel and I connected, that noise happens.
Huh. So don't get freaked out. It's just, you know.
No, We're over it now. We just say hi to the CIA when we hear it.
I've had plenty of adventures with telephones over the years, so.
I can imagine.
Which I'm going to ask you about, but finish. You can finish what you're saying, Frank, and then, yes, I do want to ask you about that so they can hear it, and it kind of goes with the whole trajectory of the episode. But go ahead.
So this might zero me too much to put on the podcast, but yeah, I was a seminarian before stuff. I was a seminarian with the Diocese of Buffalo. I'm not anymore. We're trying to basically, we work with all the victims, and we're trying to just help the victims and help them get some measure of peace and justice. But no, I went after Buffalo, he's just as much of a disaster pedophile cult as the Diocese of Buffalo is. And the day they told us to pray for the pedophile who just got arrested who did tape a 12-year-old boy using a bathroom 30 miles across town, when the bishop told us to pray for that man, that was my last day at that seminary.
Huh. Well, I bet you the bishop prayed for him, probably.
I think he was one of his good friends.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, why he was even living in the campuses with the same as us and not telling us is just one of their many things. So when I was in Buffalo, yeah, I saw a lot of corruption, and then a lot of stuff I couldn't explain. And then it led down a really weird road of, we discovered that they were moving seminarians from Columbia in this seminarian pipeline. And they were of age, but barely, 18, 20 to 20-year-old, early 20-year-old guys, and Gina's uncle was one of the most prolific pedophiles in the area, Art Smith, and he was heavily involved with this to the point where he was seen riding around Buffalo with Colombian boys in his car and bringing them out to his lake house. All these pedophiles had these lake cabins. So there was this network of these pedophiles that's still operating, covering for each other. A lot of them haven't gotten in trouble. They've never arrested one pedophile.
It's very similar. So like Gina's uncle, Art Smith, having like a secluded lake cabin. It's very kind of Francis Sheldon just bringing them to very remote places. And so I'm going to kind of get on to track of like how Nick can kind of help us connect, the dots of like the Franklin scandal and your expertise with, you know, what's going on in Buffalo and all of that type of thing. So you can see, I mean, obviously it's corrupt, and you know that most of the Catholic churches are. Buffalo could be one of the worst. But Nick, I wanted to, I guess, maybe start with this. Like, I want to kind of compare the similarities between the Franklin scandal and what Father Joe died trying to expose. And like the dangers you faced, trying to expose us still face. Eventually, maybe, we can maybe go into Gary Caradore's tragic death. Like, it's not out of the realm of possibility for someone like Father Joe, who admitted the Friday before he was murdered, I mean, allegedly murdered, but he was killed. You don't shoot yourself twice. But, covered up as a suicide. But, the Friday before he was found with two gunshot wounds in his head, with no prior instances. He did his taxes actually the day before. That was one of the craziest things I remember. And I couldn't believe his twin sister never told me that, but I was going through his files one time when I was visiting Buffalo, researching this and down in her basement. I was like, he did his taxes the day before. I don't think that someone that did their taxes the day before plans to get their own life. But anywho, but he made the fatal mistake of admitting or getting in a fight with a guy named Butch Mazur, a priest, and some other guys I think were there, saying basically, I'm about ready to expose you to this meeting planned, and he was dead shortly thereafter. So anyways, Nick, can you talk a little bit about like the dangers of speaking out about this stuff, like what you faced?
A lot of people ask me, why are you still alive? I've been asked that question a number of times. And I was smart about it in a lot of ways, and I was lucky in a lot of ways. When I first went to Nebraska, I knew that something had happened, but I was very skeptical of a transcontinental pedophile network that was hooked up to the CIA and blackmail, and also was plundering Boys Town. I was pretty skeptical of that. But I studied philosophy in college, and my goal is always to keep my mind open, to approach everything agnostically. So I went to Nebraska, and I tried to make as much noise as possible. and draw as much attention to me as possible, because I wanted to see if anything would happen. And then I was staying with a friend of mine. This is in 2002, and I didn't even have a cell phone. I'm very much a Luddite. And the Nebraska State Patrol started to call. I was staying with a friend of mine, Dirk, and the Nebraska State Patrol started to call Dirk, and I never made contact with the Nebraska State Patrol. And then I was driving on this country road. My internal GPS is really severely flawed. I mean, even with MapQuest and Google Maps, I still get lost. So I was driving down this road, and I came to like a triple fork. And I slowed down. And this road, I'd say, was about a half a mile long. So I slowed down, and then I came to a stop, and I looked in my rearview mirror, and there was a blue sedan that stopped. And I kind of felt like maybe I just might be followed at this point. And I went and talked to a victim who really didn't want to talk to me. But I went and talked to a victim, and then when I was driving back to Omaha, that blue sedan was really on me. And I hit my brakes a couple of times, and it would back off. And then I eventually got off on an exit ramp, and it kept going. And when I'm really stressed out, I like to eat ice cream sandwiches. So I had a couple of ice cream sandwiches, and then I drove back to Omaha, and then I didn't see the car. And then on my last night in Omaha, and my friend, he was kind of shaking trees too, and he came across someone who sells weed, and that's his vocation. And his friend started to break down crying. He said that he had provided drugs to that network and that he'd witnessed some horrific things.
Oh, wow.
And he wouldn't talk to me, but then I eventually was able to talk to him. So my buddy, who initially thought I was crazy on my first night, and I was trying to explain this to him at a Chinese restaurant, thought, Nick, I don't know. He might have smoked too much pot in his youth or something. So, and then on my last night there, I was waiting for my buddy to come back to his place. And this is an apartment complex. And this really funky woman came up, knocked on the door, and said she wanted to give me a book. And at this point, I was really freaked out. And I did not want her fingerprints in my buddy's apartment, and I did not want my fingerprints on the book. So I said to her to leave, and she kept on knocking on the door, and then she eventually left. And then my buddy came back, and he had some groceries, and he passed the woman in the hallway of the apartment complex. And I said to him, I said, have you ever seen her before? And he goes, no. But, I mean, he was kind of taken aback because she was kind of freaky looking. And so he was going to make dinner. He's a very good cook, I should add. He was going to make dinner, and then she came back and started knocking on the door. And then we had a huddle away from the door, and I said, well, I just don't feel comfortable with, given what I've uncovered, I don't feel comfortable with her fingerprints in your apartment or my fingerprints on the book. And I should say, I talked to a number of people when I was being very loud about it. And It was like I was doing an expose on the KGB and Stalinist Russia. People were terrified, really terrified. So this woman eventually said to me, "You're in great danger, and they're going to kill you." She didn't say who they were, but and my friend and I, we had a very nice dinner that night, but I don't think either one of us slept very well. And then I slept the next day, and I came back to New York, and I was walking through Washington Square Park with my mentor, and really wonderful guy, retired journalist, and we would have breakfast every Saturday morning, and really loved him. As much as I can love anybody, I loved him. And I was really paranoid. I was looking for snipers on the roof at that point.
Oh, wow.
And then we sat down, and he said, "You know, this is going to be dangerous, and I won't have less respect for you if you decide not to pursue it." And I said, "Jerry, I think I have to do this. I mean, this thing was so big and so evil. I have to give it a shot. I mean, I realize that it's going to be a David versus Goliath, but I have to give it a shot." So at that point, I had a number of my friends call me and ask me what it was like in Nebraska. And I said, "Oh, man, it's really dangerous. It's really dangerous. I'm going to stay away from Nebraska for the rest of my life." And then at that point, I still continued to look into things, but I didn't make any calls to Nebraska other than my buddy. And then the next time I went to Nebraska, and this would happen all the time, how I went to Nebraska. I'm from Minneapolis, so I'd fly to Minneapolis, and I'd have a friend of mine rent a car, and then I would just use cash. And then I would go to Nebraska, and eventually, I know that the dark, malignant corner of the government that does this type of stuff realized that I wasn't going away. And then at that point, I started to get some harassment via the phone.
How did they do that? You would just get calls from random numbers?
Yeah, sometimes they would play nice music. But once I was talking to a former Nebraska senator, and the line went dead. And then all of a sudden there was heavy breathing. And I had recorded it, and I named that particular recording Pet Sounds. And then I was with Rusty Nelson, who's kind of an infamous character, and he was a blackmail photographer for that network. And
blackmail photographer. Oh, so that was who he was considered. It was, but he was taking. Oh, I thought he was because he thought he took you to go find the cache of the child sex abuse material with child porn. I was trying to.
I mean, that's how he got it, is because he was a blackmail photographer.
Oh, okay.
And actually, he gave pictures to Gary Caradore in Chicago. I do believe that. I've got a lot of corroboration on it, and that's when Gary Caradore, when he's flying back to Lincoln, his plane blew up. But Rusty took me on. Rusty had he was a sex offender, and he hadn't registered as a sex offender. The one thing about the guy, I got to say this, he's an ethical eunuch, but he is a good photographer. And he'd open up a photography studio, and then the Nebraska State Patrol, like, the next day just raided it and took everything. And so he was kind of upset, and I told him that I would pay for an attorney if he gave me blackmail pictures. Because in New York, I was just facing waves of incredulity, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to get some pictures, I think. And he took me on a wild goose chase for pictures. But when we were driving on this...
In the state of Colorado, correct? Wasn't it?
Yes. So we were driving back, and I got pulled over by an arrest state patrol officer who really didn't look like a Nebraska state patrol officer. Now, I don't mean to offend Nebraska state patrol officers, but most of the ones that I've met are kind of sloven and overweight. Now, this guy was good looking and tan and cut, and he pulled me over. He said I was doing 65 and a 60, which is entirely possible. But I gave him my driver's license, and he barely looked at it. And he said, all right, into my car. He escorted me to his car. And then I felt this guy, I got weird vibes from him. But then another Nebraska State Patrol officer arrived who looked more like a Nebraska State Patrol officer. And when I'm talking about slobbing and corpulent. And and then he had a dog. And then and actually they took Rusty out of the car, and they deposited him between the cruiser that I was in and then the other cruiser. And then they just tore apart my car, my rental car. And I can remember, and I put this in the Franklin Scout, when I was driving away, Rusty turned to me, because I'd gotten very upset at Rusty when I realized that this was a goose chase, wild goose chase, and I'm very upset. And he turned to me and he said, do you know how lucky you are? And what he meant by that is, you know, if you had had blackmail pictures, bad things would have happened to you. But here's the thing about that. And when I say I was smart and I was lucky, before I went out on the road on that particular outing, I made a video. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of people make a video, and I said exactly who I was going to be with, exactly where we were going to go, and exactly what I was looking for. So if I was arrested, I would have that video, and of course, if I never returned, that video would have hit the internet. So
very smart.
Yeah, I tried to be pretty methodical about what I was doing, and actually, I gave a lot of with most of my moves, it was a lot of premeditation.
Well, and a lot of times, though, you also put yourself in danger in terms of, like, granted, these were victims, and they eventually ended up like crying like babies to you because it's just so heartbreaking. But, like, you know, you went and asked people. Victims of the worst thing that's ever happened to them, you know, and what basically ruined their life. I forget the name of the guy. You said you described him like a pit bull. He was on meth and other things.
Rue Fox.
What was his name again? Rue Fox?
Rue Fox. Yeah,
Rue Fox. Poor guy. But, like, yeah, I mean, like, he basically threatened to beat you up and everything, but then...
Well, he threatened to snap my neck. Snap is an exact quote.
Oh my gosh. But so I think why I think you haven't been killed yet is I think that you have a charming personality, you don't make yourself seem better than anyone. Like you talk about your, you know, childhood, like hitchhiking around and partaking in various drugs, even joining a cult at a certain point.
yeah.
So you're not trying to make yourself seem better than these people. But then you're also, you know, funny and kind and also somehow not threatening, if that makes sense. So maybe that's why I am surprised the government or those people haven't tried to kill you. I mean, they followed you, but and there they go. I just said the government, and the beep just went off.
When they try to make those, when you make tapes like that, like when you have insurance policies that they can't touch you, like Nick Saini did, that kind of puts them in a box where what are they going to do? Like, are they going to expose themselves further by doing that and, you know, making another murder scene and then having more stuff come out?
Well,
or is it best, just better for them to cut their losses?
That's how I feel about the podcast and Father Joe. Like, you're not you're not going to kill the person. Like, that'd be pretty obvious. Like, I'm not worried about them killing me or Greg or any, but like, you know, you're not, that would be real obvious to be reporting or exposing a murder and then the journalist gets killed. Like, I think that's just kind of like, that'd be stupid. Now, I worry a tad more about, like, Gina, who had a tracking device put on her vehicle recently. But you're now publicly exposed on the podcast, Gina, so I don't know. Okay, we can go into that more. But so, Nick,
I think another variable is Danny Casolaro.
Who's that?
And he was a journalist that was looking into the financial side of what I was looking into. I was looking into the child trafficking side. There's a very dark, malignant corner of our intelligence that does all kinds of things, from trafficking children to trafficking drugs to securities fraud. And Danny Casolaro, there's a really good Netflix docuseries that was made about him. It's called American Conspiracy. I would suggest that anybody who's listening check it out. And he was murdered with, I think that the people that murdered him thought that they could murder him with impunity. But he became a martyr. Although there were some mainstream media outlets that tried to make him look delusional, like Vanity Fair. But he became a martyr. And ultimately, these two guys, Zach and his buddy, I can't think of his buddy's name, they really did demonstrate that Danny Casolaro was murdered. Whereas Vanity Fair said he was delusional and he killed himself. But despite that, and no one in his family thought that he killed himself. Actually, no one in his life thought that he killed himself. So I think that there's the Danny Casolaro factor, too.
Yeah, that's something to add into the research for Father Joe's case. I think you know enough about, I've explained enough about it, but, like, I mean, there's so many levels to why Father Joe did not kill himself, besides just, you know, the forensics, like when they exhumed his body, Cyril Wecht, you know, the guy that did JonBenet Ramsey's autopsy, Anna Nicole Smith, JFK's actually, which is crazy that he's that old, although he did just recently pass away. Rest in peace, Cyril Wecht. He actually appeared on our podcast to explain this too. But like, you know, besides just the forensics, and, you know, there's so many, many things, like in his crime scene photos, his desk drawer was broken into. So we already knew that based on the crime scene photos and who would break into their own desk. Well, Gina, bravely, well, her Uncle Art Smith, who I would like to talk to you about him and Jack Kemp in a little bit, but Gina finds out that her uncle is dying of pancreatic cancer. Gina can't stand her uncle. Her uncle abused her brother. Sorry, Gina, I'm giving the cliff notes. It's your story, but I'm just cliff noting it.
No, it's perfect.
Art Smith is one of the most, you know, prolific pedophiles in the Buffalo Diocese and likely beyond, because one of the men that we interviewed, heartbreaking, his name's Kevin Brunn, and I can say his name because he went on the podcast. Who was abused by Gina's uncle Art Smith while in Washington, D.C. on a trip with Jack Kemp. He was abused. He tells us the horrible story. It's very sad. He cries. then tells the story of his son finding a journal entry of him saying this is what happened to him, and then his son kills himself the next day because it traumatized him so much. Gina tends to believe that this is another not suicide. I don't know. It seems that Kevin believes that his son did kill himself, but
yeah, I would like to add that there's not any evidence that just for that case, I don't think there's a lot there in that terms.
Was Kevin molested by Kemp?
No, he was molested by Art Smith on a trip. So Art took...
With Kemp?
Yes. So there's a photo of Art and Jack Kemp on that trip. Gina, can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, so I have all my old stuff from my grandmother's house, and I was going through a folder that was all about my uncle, and there was all these newspaper clippings about him in there. And there was one from 1976 from the Buffalo News where my uncle is with Jack Kemp at Washington, D.C. And I believe and I think that the chances are very likely it's the same trip that Kevin Brunn was on with my uncle. So they went to Washington, D.C., met with Jack Kemp. But when Kevin was asked if he met Jack Kemp, he really couldn't remember the trip. He was so distraught the whole time. So he was not abused by Jack Kemp, but he was somehow placed in the same hotel room with my uncle. So we know how well that ended.
So also exposed in the Franklin scandal was Jack Kemp. He was exposed in this book. Last episode, you heard from Kevin Brunn, who was abused by Art Smith on a trip that he took along with Art Smith and other students to Washington, D.C., where they met Congressman Jack Kemp. When Gina, Art's niece, initially sent me a photo of Art with Jack Kemp on that late 1970s trip, my brain spiraled. I knew that name. I knew I'd read it before. Not because I'm a huge 1970s Buffalo Bills fan. Yes, Republican Congressman Jack Kemp started his career playing professional football for 13 years for the Bills and the Chargers. He actually threw the ball several times to O.J. Simpson while both were playing for the Bills. True history is stranger than fiction.
Oh, go ahead.
Jack Kemp plays an integral role, and he's part of Franklin.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. So Gina tells me this story. She's saying, my uncle was connected to Washington or whatever, and she says the name Jack Kemp, and I'm on the phone with Gina, and I was like, I'm almost 100% certain that name is mentioned in the Franklin. I am almost 100% certain. So I go to the Kindle version of your book, and I type in Kemp, and I was like, yep, that is exactly who that is. I knew the name right away. Yeah, there's our beep.
How was Kemp involved with the Franklin scandal?
Kemp and King were very close. When Kemp was running for president, King actually had this extravaganza plan for him with all kinds of flowers in the pool. And then all of a sudden Kemp pulled out really quickly. But King had a party in New Orleans for George Herbert Walker Bush in 1988 for his nomination. And Kemp was one of the dignitaries that was at the party.
He also had that, which also feels like isolation to me too, similar to the Francis Sheldon and I hate to say it because he was the guy he owned the place with was an outed homosexual, which nothing wrong with being gay, all good, no problem. Just not with children. You know the story. This is from your book. I just was rereading part of it. But there was, rumors of Kemp being gay and, going to these parties and stuff, and that ski lodge, right, was a sort of a little gay haven.
Yes. And Kemp said that Kemp was actually a very good quarterback. And he said that he bought
part of his part of the lodge to because it was a good investment. that's what he came up with.
Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly. But it is really weird to me that it always feels like these like isolated sort of enclaves, like, you know, where I always think when I think about the like the Francis Shelton thing or even Boys Town, I was just reading an article from fairly recently, and there's only like fairly recently like about 300 residents there, and so far just reported in the last couple of years, and that's what's been reported, 12 rapes amongst those kids. 12 of 300, pretty horrific numbers, but and I'm imagining it's much more. But like I think about the Francis Shelton thing where the kids thought they were going to some sort of like summer camp thing on this island, and there's only one way in, one way out, and it's via plane, and then they're stuck on this island, you know, with these predators, similar to Epstein. Yeah, I guess Epstein's that. Yeah, there you go.
Nick, I have a quick question for you that's related. So if you have what we kind of saw here in Buffalo in the diocese and everywhere else, because Buffalo's about 50 years behind everyone else, we saw that it wasn't so much that it was just the pedophiles or just the closeted gay priest, but it was like this unholy alliance between the two, because back then the gay men weren't like socially allowed to come out. So a lot of those dirty secrets became, you know, they weren't dirty secrets, but like it became blackmail. They became blackmailable by these same pedophiles. So the pedophile kind of took advantage of that. And then they all kind of started going in the same club. Is that your experience as well?
Well, that was a big thing with the mafia, was to own gay clubs. The mafia owned many of the gay clubs in New York City.
Oh.
And that was all blackmail.
Oh.
And the mafia is also very good at blackmail. I mean, they're good at killing people, too, but they're also good at blackmail. And that was and actually, I know someone whose father owned a bunch of those clubs. And unbelievably, this person has grown up to be a very productive member of society and
wow.
in the healthcare field.
You don't have to say that person's name, but would you be able to tell me some of those clubs? And then I may also then transition into an Epstein connection with this in a club that knows about. But what do you remember the name of the?
I think Stonewall was definitely one of them.
Oh, Stonewall. Oh, yeah, I do remember that Stonewall was, yeah, mafia-owned. Yeah, God, I love that they did high kicks. That Stonewall is one of my favorite stories, that the drag queens sort of did, like, they did a kick line to the cops. And so that's a great story.
Okay, so Franklin Scandal, I read it while I was in seminary, and it made ton of sense. You know, a lot of the same things that you were saying, we were seeing. So if we have kind of the same thing going on here in Buffalo, like we suspect, that there's this pedophile cult that's operating at basically all levels of government, and it's infiltrated the church and the government, and we even believe, well, we know now with all the circumstantial evidence, police and the district attorney's office and the medical examiner's office, literally every level of government. So if that's the case, and like, how do we, number one, would be some of the signs that a pedophile cult, other than like the obvious, may be operating in your area?
I have a tendency to think that these type of networks are ubiquitous. I mean, it's unfortunate. I get emails every day from people all over the country asking me to investigate something. And some of them, I think, are really valid. I mean, some of them are kind of unhinged, but some of them are valid. And it kind of breaks my heart in a way, because I always have to tell them that I'm just one guy and against the machine, and I do not have time to investigate your allegations. I'm really sorry about that. And
it's really, that's difficult for me.
Yeah.
So what would be some of the common, we have tons of kids and young adults. So ever since the church, it seems like the church was maybe allegedly trafficking children. And then when they got in trouble, maybe that dried up or something, that all the kids that they were moving through, they couldn't do that anymore. So now we've been having this new phenomenon of all of these kids going missing on almost a daily basis, and young girls getting kidnapped from Ubers. And you hear five stories over the summer about young girls running out of Ubers half naked, drugged, running into random people's houses asking for help, and then it quickly gets covered up. So I wanted to see from your point of view and with the Franklin scandal and everything, what are the common methods used by the pedophile cults to recruit and abuse these children?
I mean, predators know how to prey. Heroin addicts find each other. Crack addicts find each other. Pedophiles find each other. I mean, that's just the way it is. With Buffalo, I researched something that I found was interesting. There is a group within the Freemasons called the Gestures. And a number of years ago, they were busted. They would take these trips down the Amazon, and there would be underage girls that would be provided to them at the various villages that they docked at. And this went very, very high. I believe that a governor of either Arizona or New Mexico was involved in it. And there were two governors of New Mexico involved with Epstein. But I came across some pretty interesting stuff about the Jesters in Buffalo. And they were having like orgy-like parties. Oh. And they were kind about it. I mean, it got covered up pretty quickly. But I think that that could be another strata of child abuse in Buffalo is the Jesters. Because they seem to be a bad lot. I mean,
very interesting. Yeah, that's actually, there's a lot of people talking about right now how Diddy is allegedly involved with them.
Well, Nick knows a lot about Diddy.
Diddy is, it's hard to know how plugged in Diddy is with various fraternities and organizations. But I think my belief is that Diddy, he started Bad Boy Records in 1993 with Clive Davis.
Yep.
And Clive Davis is like a nasty piece of work. I was just on Michael Franzese's podcast. He was a capo in the Colombo family. And he knew about Clive Davis. Everybody that I know that's older, that's been in music, everybody knows about Clive Davis, that he would claim co-authorship of songs that he never wrote. And he ripped off a lot of artists. He launched a lot of careers, but he ripped off a lot of artists. But when you look at his criminality, he's been busted three times for defrauding the IRS. Not one, not two, but three times. He was involved in the biggest payola scandal ever in the record industry. And payola is when record companies give money to DJs and radio stations play their songs, and that's been outlawed. And then there was a Genovese guy named Pasquale Falcone. Now, that's a good name for a Genovese guy, Pasquale Falcone. But he got busted smuggling in a bunch of heroin into the United States. And then when the feds started to drill into his life, they found that he and Clive Davis owned a bunch of shell companies together.
Wow.
And Clive Davis was funneling money from CBS Records into those shell companies, and then him and Falcone were splitting it up. Now, with all that criminality, and that's the criminality that we know about, you would think that the guy would have done some time. Clive Davis did not spend a day in jail. Not a day. And the only way that you could do that, the only way that you can get away with that much criminality and not spend a day in jail is if you're working with the government. That is the only way.